Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me, as always, is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode LV, What Hadrian Loves Best. With Hadrian safely back from his travels, we now pause for a moment to look at what could be the greatest loves of Hadrian's life. All of these are open for debate. 1. Impressive buildings. 2. His wife, Vibia Sabina. And 3. A certain young man named Antinous. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
When Hadrian gets back to Rome, he needs to make his mark on the city. He's already someone known for helping out and building in the provinces. So now he needs to make himself known to the people of Rome. And he embarks upon a series of building projects, most of which we're not entirely sure exactly when they were completed, except during his reign. But some of them clearly were marked out towards the beginning of the reign in 117 or 118 when he gets back. And they're very imposing building projects because almost all of them are big buildings. So he's somebody who really does want to put his stamp on the city. And even the buildings that have been made over by emperors who follow, they can't really kind of deconstruct everything and rebuild it because it's so big to start with. So he's interested in big structures in the city, which is quite an achievement because, of course, by this point in the second century, Rome has a lot of buildings in it. And the emperors who've come before him have already put up a lot of structures. So, for example, the very middle of Rome around the Forum is kind of cluttered up with lots of emperors' fora. There's forums all over the place and there's no room for Hadrian to put one of his own there. So he has to find other spaces. And he does actually find one space very close to the Forum because there is still, after all this time, a bit of room to be used up from Nero's golden house.
Yeah.
So that's where he puts the Temple of Venus and Roma, which is the biggest temple ever built in Rome. And it's right on the edge of the Forum at the Colosseum end. It's kind of hard to miss if you exit the Forum at that side near the Arch of Titus.
How is that room still there?
Mostly because of Nero's golden house. Yeah. He does have to move something in order to construct it, but that's okay because it's that colossal statue of Nero.
The Colossus of Nero, yeah.
Which has by this point been turned into the features of the sun. Vespasian had done that. So it's technically not a statue of Nero anymore. But he moves that out of the way. He builds this enormous podium for a huge temple. It's what we call Decca style, which is nothing to do with records. It means it's got 10 columns at the front. Now, temples in the ancient world, they usually had multiples of 2 columns at the front. So 6 is quite normal. A big temple might have 8. So, for example, the Temple of Mars in the Forum of Augustus has 8. But 10 is just gigantic.
Yeah.
And it really is a huge, huge temple.
If Hadrian's got that space, which he makes free in a prime position, why does he build a temple like this? Why isn't there a Forum of Hadrian there?
Well, that's a good question. And people find it difficult to understand why he builds a temple of Venus and Roma. I mean, they're not controversial gods to be in the city of Rome, but there isn't really a cult of Roma within Rome itself. So that's quite innovative. There's cults of Roma and especially cults of the emperor connected with Rome in the provinces. But why do you need one in Rome itself? And there's loads of temples of Venus, but the two have never been brought together in this way. And they physically were brought together. So the room where the cult statue is, which is called the Cella, they're back to back. And on coins, there's a sort of cut through version of them. And you can see the goddesses standing back to back in their own real rooms. So
yeah,
it's a kind of double fronted temple. In some ways strange, and because there are so many cults of Venus, so many temples of Venus, it's a particular variety of Venus, as it were. She's called Venus Felix, which means Venus the Blessed, and the Roma is Roma Aeterna, which is Eternal Rome. This perhaps is Hadrian building something close to a forum. It's been described in that way. But instead, it's a massive temple. Because if you think about the imperial fora, they're usually a colonnade for public, you know, shops and law courts and so on, and a temple at the apex, the focal point of the forum. Instead of that, this is just all temple, yeah. all temple all the time, as it were.
Yeah.
So I think it's a mark that Hadrian's going to build big. It's also very Greek in style, so you can access it from any side, which is not the typical Roman style. So it's part of Hadrian putting his Greek stamp on the city. And it's highly visible from everywhere. So we can't be certain of why he decided to go a different way. It is an innovation in lots of ways, not just that it's not a forum, but just a temple, but in terms of whose cult it celebrates too.
Okay. One of the other big building projects that he embarks on and is known for is the Pantheon. We're going to discuss this in greater detail in When in Rome. So just give us a bit of a highlight of it. It was a rebuild of an existing Pantheon, wasn't it?
It was. It, in fact, was the third rebuilding.
Yeah.
It had been built first by Agrippa, who was Augustus's close friend. You know, it had been built in the late 1st century BCE. Seems to have been a fairly ordinary square structure at that point, or oblong. And then it had burnt down in the fire of 80 CE, so it had been rebuilt by Domitian. But then in 110, it had been struck by lightning, destroyed again. So I think this was a good building for Hadrian to rebuild because it was something he could associate with Augustus, but also something Domitian had done, so he could kind of remake what Domitian had done and wipe out Domitian yet again.
Mm.
It's a very different building from what Agrippa had done. We can tell that it's actually a completely new structure from the brick stamps. So it's not just a case of having to repair it. And the big innovation is that it's now a domed temple, which it wasn't previously. So he does something, again, extremely innovative. It's huge. It's the best preserved temple in the whole of Rome. So it's a huge tourist draw now. It's incredibly beautiful. The engineering that went into it is very, very precise. And it's a temple that Hadrian remakes, and then famously he writes on it, "Marcus Agrippa made me." So he puts back the original inscription. So this is something that Hadrian can make his own reputation indirectly as somebody who's fairly humble. And in fact, Hadrian didn't put his own name on any of his public buildings except for the Temple of the Divine Trajan.
Why is that? He wasn't shy from putting his name on buildings in other places. But Rome seems to be a different thing. Is that maybe indicating his thoughts on Rome?
It's a difficult one, isn't it? I do cling to the idea that it is a public display of humility, which in itself is a move that's not very humble at all, because people will talk about the fact that you're being humble. It is following Augustus in his footsteps, because Augustus says in his epitaph, "I repaired," and then he has a whole list of buildings. And then he writes at the end of it, "without adding my own name." So I think that he's deliberately copying Augustus and making it clear to the Romans that he's not going to be one of those "it's all about me" emperors.
But that only applies in Rome, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you need your name to be brandished about in the provinces.
Yeah.
And there's always been less reluctance to do this kind of thing in the provinces, certainly in terms of the emperor actually being worshipped, being cults to the emperor in the provinces. So maybe it's related to that as well.
Other building projects, the Mausoleum of Hadrian, which he builds across the water, because I assume because he's running out of room in Rome at that point.
Well, it's another great parallel with Augustus, though, and you can tell that if you go to Rome today, because the Mausoleum of Augustus is in the northern Campus Martius, so the very northern extremity of Rome, really, and it's right by the Tiber. It's this big brick concrete structure. And then there's a bridge, which Hadrian built, and Hadrian's mausoleum is over the other side of the Tiber. So the two of them sort of balance each other out. Not so much anymore, because the Augustus mausoleum has been stripped and kind of left like that. The mausoleum of Hadrian has been turned into the Castel San Angelo, and it's been really kind of overbuilt. And it's called that because there are angels everywhere along the bridge and all over the actual castle itself.
Yeah.
So it looks quite different. But you can see that these are two massive drum-like structures. They're both round on either side of the Tiber. So this is often read as Hadrian saying, "Well, I'm like Augustus, but I'm not going to say I'm as good as Augustus because I've put mine over the other side, non-central, non-core side of the Tiber. You can see the parallels. You can see that I'm talking about similarities, but I'm not pretending that I directly compare myself to Augustus.
Mm, mm. He also built it at exactly the same size, well, you know, as best as they could back then, as Augustus's mausoleum.
Yeah, so no, they're
not pretty... not bigger, but, you know, just as good.
And it's a very dynastic statement. Mm. Not that Hadrian is starting the dynasty, really, because if you wanted to say that, I suppose it's Nerva or maybe Trajan. There's a lot of talk in the scholarship about the way that Hadrian makes these moves, especially with these big buildings, of making this kind of announcement that this is the new golden age of Rome, but very specifically that it started in the reign of Trajan, that this is the dynastic move, but he's kind of tracing it to his adopted father, Trajan, that these markers on the landscape indicate that parallel with the golden age that Augustus is meant to have started. The last structure we should mention that's very important for Hadrian is the temple to his dead father, the deified Trajan. It's actually a temple of deified Trajan and Plotina, so it recognizes both of them. And it's actually in the Forum of Trajan. So he's very directly making the link to how he's continuing what Trajan does. So finishing off the Forum, in effect. And usually you'll pick someone like Venus or Mars to put in there as the cult statue. But here he's put in a deified emperor. Mm. And that's the first time that happens in an imperial forum. So it's like he's finishing off Trajan's Forum with Trajan in deified form. We think it was quite a big temple, but it's hard to excavate it. It's under a palazzo at the sort of far end of Trajan's Forum now. It's the only building on which he put his own name. So that dynastic connection is very important to him. He doesn't need to put it anywhere else in Rome, but he needs to say that he built the temple of the deified Trajan.
All right, so now we're just going to completely tangent that and do a couple of mini episodes within the episode on a couple of people who are close to Hadrian. We'll start with his wife, Vibia Sabina. So who was she before she became Mrs. Hadrian?
So Vibia Sabina was part of that very complicated Romano-Spanish family tree of Hadrian and Trajan, because she's related to both of them distantly. So she's part of that Spanish aristocracy from ancient Rome. Let me try to explain this. Trajan's sister, who's called Marciana, was Sabina's grandmother. So Trajan is her great uncle. Trajan, of course, adopted Hadrian. So she's related to Hadrian by adoption, but she's already related to Hadrian by blood because, of course, Hadrian's father was Trajan's cousin and also Marciana's cousin. Not so closely that we would consider it incest, or the ancient Romans did either, but they are part of the same extended family.
So distantly related, but politically, why was she a good match for Hadrian to be married to?
Presumably the theory is that it strengthens the hand of that Romano-Spanish contingent to kind of keep it within the family. Mm. Certainly the profile of everybody within that family is raised as soon as Trajan becomes emperor. The marriage seems to have been pushed by Trajan's wife, Plotina, who of course took a lot of interest in Hadrian and was instrumental in him becoming emperor and being adopted. This implies that she's trying to ensure the power base of that family is continued.
Mm-hmm. But they got married in a time before Hadrian was adopted, isn't
long
that the
before.
Case?
Yeah, in about 100 CE, so not long after Trajan had become emperor.
So it was almost a building block of trying to build up his legitimacy, if that is the case of maneuvering.
That's probably true. I mean, I suppose you could go two ways about this. You could marry him into some long-standing Italian-Roman family to give him legitimacy.
Yeah.
But in terms of kind of raising his profile within that family, this works quite well, making the connection to Trajan even stronger.
What do we know about their relationship? Do we know anything at all?
We know very little, and the bits and pieces we know, largely from the Augustan history, make it seem like quite a bleak marriage. They didn't have any children, but that is true of many of the imperial marriages, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a successful marriage. If you think of Augustus and Livia, they don't have children together, but they're considered a successful marriage and a good marriage in terms of the power base of the two families. But the only evidence we have comes from the Augustan history, chapter 11, in the life of Hadrian, where we're told that he's getting rid of various people. He removed from office Septicius Clarus, the prefect of the guard, and Suetonius Tranquillus, the imperial secretary, who, of course, is our famous Suetonius.
Yeah, yeah. We discussed this during Suetonius. This was after he came back from England at one point.
And many others besides, because without his consent, they'd been conducting themselves towards his wife, Sabina, in a more informal fashion than the etiquette of the court demanded. All right. So the implication is that she has possibly been involved in affairs or encouraging affairs. And as he was himself wont to say, he would have sent away his wife too on the ground of ill temper and irritability had he been merely a private citizen.
So her status saved her at that point.
Yeah, that's what the claim in the Augustan history is, that he's in too prominent a position. I'm not sure that washes with me because divorce was so common in ancient Rome, unless you're going to argue that things are changing for the imperial family at this point, that they are more like our royal family and have to be exemplars to the people.
Mm.
But divorce had never been particularly frowned upon, especially from the point of view of the husbands previously.
The only other mention that we've got in the Augustan histories, besides that one that she was indiscreet, is in regards to her death. And it's just a couple of sentences, isn't it?
Yep. In chapter 23, so further on in his life, is that she died a year before Hadrian did. So in other words, in 137. And the quote from chapter 23 is, "He put many others to death, either openly or by treachery. And indeed, when his wife Sabina died, the rumour arose that the emperor had given her poison." I'm not sure I'd put much trust in anything that even the Augustan history calls a rumour.
Mm.
So it's very hard to judge. And as I say, we know very little other than that about Sabina. We know that she was openly celebrated on coinage. So certainly in terms of his public reputation, she's important there.
And she is buried right next to him in the mausoleum.
She's buried in the mausoleum. That's important. Mm. But of course, you'd really have to disgrace yourself not to be buried in the mausoleum if you're that close to the emperor. There are lots of statues of Sabina where she's depicted again with this classical beauty, these gorgeous features. So she was on public display a lot.
Okay, so clearly important to his image in many ways and his shoring up his legitimacy as being an heir of Trajan. But at the same time, I gather that Sabina and Hadrian didn't have the most loving of a relationship, given how close Hadrian was to who we're now going to talk about, which is Antinous. So who was he and what was he to Hadrian?
Antinous was Hadrian's lover. He was a teenager who was born in modern-day Turkey in Bithynia. And Hadrian met him there in about 123 CE. And he travelled with Hadrian on his big journey during those years. And he seems to have been very, very close to Hadrian and much beloved by Hadrian, which has led lots of people to say that Hadrian was homosexual and that's why his marriage was not successful. It's quite hard to make those kind of judgment calls or categories about ancient Roman men because, of course, lots of them did have boy loves while being married. That wasn't really seen as something conflicting. But with Hadrian, it does seem to be quite marked, and the biographers and Dio talk a lot about Antinous. And the reason for that is that Hadrian does seem to have been obsessed with Antinous and to have been much closer to him than you would expect of that kind of relationship normally.
Mm.
So whether you'd actually call Hadrian homosexual, you know, the way we use that category today is quite debatable. But certainly he seems to have been fascinated by and perhaps what we would call in love with Antinous. One of the reasons we know this is that there are lots of statues of Antinous. So
yeah,
I said
yeah.
There are lots of Sabina. There are even more of Antinous. And he is depicted as absolutely perfect, just this incredibly beautiful young man.
So to give a bit of a crib notes summary, he met Hadrian in 123 and then travelled with him for a while, went back to Rome, had a close relationship with him that certainly might have made things a bit difficult with Sabina. And then he died quite early. So do we know what year he died?
He died in 130 when he was supposed to have been just 19.
Right. With around Hadrian for, you know, maybe about 7 years, five, 7 years or so.
Yes. And he died in a very dramatic way because he drowned in the Nile while they were on tour in Egypt. And Hadrian seems to have been absolutely bereft, you know, like half of his soul had been ripped out. It's a very controversial death. There are various different accounts of it. Certainly in the Augustan history and the main historian for this period, Dio, we get a lot more mention of Antinous than we do of Sabina. So, for example, in chapter 13 of the Augustan history, Life of Hadrian, we get a paragraph that tells us during a journey on the Nile, he lost Antinous, his favourite. And for this youth, he wept like a woman. You can see there's a bit of a put down there, as there usually is in the Augustan history.
Just a bit of a kick while he's mourning, yeah.
Concerning this incident, there are varying rumours. For some claim that he had devoted himself to death for Hadrian. In other words, he'd sacrificed himself as part of a promise he had made, something like that.
Mm.
And Dio actually backs that up as well and talks about these rumours. He says that Hadrian honoured Antinous, either because of his love for him or because the youth had voluntarily undertaken to die, it being necessary that a life should be surrendered freely for the accomplishment of the ends Hadrian had in view, whatever that means. The connection there seems to be that for the Romans, when an animal was sacrificed, which is the normal sacrifice, there was this idea that the animal had to be killed willingly.
Yeah.
So if it looks like the animal's struggling, then that's a bad omen. Now, this seems very strange to us that anyone should think an animal wants to die freely, but that's kind of the requirement. And this is being extended to Antinous here with this rumour that he has sacrificed himself for Hadrian, perhaps to save Hadrian in some way, and that he actually went to it willingly. But maybe if there were already rumours about him being murdered, this is something to counter that.
So whether it be accident, sacrifice or murder, Hadrian's reaction to it makes me think that, well, one, he had nothing to do with it. And two, going to the point of deification, if he says that Antinous sacrificed himself, it kind of gives him a bit of a reason or justification for deifying him to begin with. Discuss.
That may be so.
It sounds like an essay question. Yeah. Off you go.
That may be so. Certainly deification is an enormous honour and one that hasn't been given to anybody outside the imperial family before. Relatively rare for women within the imperial family. It's usually the emperor. But this is somebody who can't be married into the imperial family. So it's the first time someone outside that family gets this honour. So it's a big deal in terms of status. It really raises his status. It nullifies his death, which I think is quite important if we're talking about Hadrian being bereft.
Mm.
Because if you deify someone, then they don't really have the same funeral rites as everyone else because technically they're not dead. They're a god. It may be, if we're going to play armchair psychologists, that this counters the fact that Antinous is dead. And of course, it probably is very unexpected if Antinous is so young. It's something that is another novelty that we've talked about, how Hadrian does lots of things that are novel, that are innovative. And this is certainly one of them. And I think it's the main reason that the historians and the biographer pay so much attention to Antinous. So It may not be that there was so much written about what happened during Antinous's life in terms of his importance to Hadrian. But what happens afterwards, so we get the deification, which means we get a cult, which means we get temples, we get a city named after him. We get statues of him everywhere, where he's depicted as a pharaoh or as Apollo, so in the guises of gods and other rulers. We get a games dedicated to Antinous, which is a very Greek way of celebrating a cult hero, Hadrian being Greek again, as it were. Hadrian even claimed that he'd seen a new star in the heavens, which he said was Antinous's soul. So there's so much attention paid to this boy who has not been an official part of the imperial family that I think struck people as very unusual. Seems to speak of a very intense relationship and a huge sense of loss on the part of Hadrian. From an almost flippant point of view, deification is becoming a bit cheap by now, in my view, because Hadrian starts to deify all kinds of people. There's his mother-in-law and, you know, obviously his wife and his sister. Almost every woman in the imperial family gets deified after they die. The point that Dio makes about Antinous, which I think partly answers your point, is that Hadrian was criticized for deifying Antinous straight away, whereas he took a while to get around to it with his sister Paulina.
Mm.
So this is Dio in Book 64, Chapter 11, the point I made before about the star that Hadrian saw had really come into being from the spirit of Antinous. On this account, then, he became the object of some ridicule, because at the death of his sister Paulina, he had not immediately paid her any honour. So the ridicule doesn't seem to come quite so directly from what I might have expected from the fact that Hadrian has paid honours to somebody who's sort of remote from the imperial family.
Yeah.
But from the speed with which he did it, and he didn't always do it so quickly with people like his sister.
I think the last thing to maybe take away from this is that it would have been a good way to curry favour with the emperor if you pay homage to Antinous or do something in his honour. So that might have helped fuel the building up of this cult. This is clearly somebody that Hadrian loved very much. Let's put a bunch of statues here. Let's dedicate this to Antinous. Let's name this city after him, although Hadrian did that himself. It was a city where he died, actually, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a city that is kind of built on the spot where he died.
But that might have been a good way, a quick way to build up the cult to the extent that it did.
Yes, and it seems like there wasn't any kind of reluctance to do this, particularly in the eastern provinces, which is, of course, where Antinous is originally from. You can imagine that there would have been quite a lot of enthusiasm to embrace kind of one of their own who's become springboarded to this highly prominent role by his connection to the emperor. So it's quite easy to see why his cult would be taken up in the east in particular. And of course, this would make you look favourable to the emperor, who's so invested in this.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. A big thanks to everybody who have been leaving reviews there recently. You can like this podcast on Facebook. There's a lot of you there now. You are all wonderful people. And you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Hadrian, you were doing so well, man. Why did you need to do that to the Jews? But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.